This is HPR episode 2972 for Tuesday, the 24th of December 2019. Today's show is entitled The Foot of the Ski Slope. It is hosted by Dave Morris and is about 45 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is MRX and Dave Morris chat about nerdy things near a ski slope.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Everybody, this is Hack Public Radio. Welcome to our show, and it's our show because it's me, Dave Morris, and
Mr. X.
And we're doing another one of our get-togethers and wee chats and stuff like that.
We're in your studio C, which is your car.
yeah. It's really the acoustics are fantastic. Yeah. One of the things about when we meet up, we've discovered is we've got tons to talk about.
Yeah.
But we go and have breakfast or sit inside somewhere in a noisy environment and have a chat. Yeah. And we've been doing that for the past Is it near a couple of hours now? I think.
Yeah.
About half 10.
And now we've run a completely different thing to
and
talk about.
We, that's right. We've covered so much ground. And now we come out here to record something and we're thinking, what to talk about?
Yeah. So it's a pity we could have sort of in a stilted manner recap all the things we're talking about.
I don't hardly remember anything.
I know, this is it, exactly.
So. What have you got anything? Well, I know you have because you've got a bit of paper there in front of you, which is more efficient than I have been in this case.
I came. I was at a meeting and I supplied this old. Well, it's a radio meeting actually, and I was supplied this sort of big woolly sock, and said, "There you go." What the heck's in this? It's a big lumpy woolly sock, and I sort of manipulated it, and this lump came out the end of it. And I opened it, and it was a keyboard and a screen, and it was a Gemini PDA, which of course is the kind of modern version of the Cyan 5C or something, isn't it?
Yeah, that's so, right. It was the later generation of it, wasn't it? It was really quite a sophisticated device.
I think it can run Android and a special version of Android. I think it can run a special version of Linux as well. I think it can run Debian and various other things as well, actually.
Oh, wow.
But I did think about it, you know, but me being a canny stroke mean Scot... I decided not to bother.
Quite an interesting novelty, but whether you'd want to part with real cash.
Yeah, they were very expensive
like
at the time.
Yeah.
This is it. So
it's, in that era of PDAs and stuff like that, everybody who was anybody had them.
Of course, just thinking that maybe our American audience might not know what Cyan is. I don't know. It's sort of clamshell PDA type thing, wasn't it? It was kind of similar to the Microsoft Windows CE thing. Bill Gates wrote a thing in his email saying that he cited Cyan as being the biggest threat to Microsoft. It's a tiny British company that he thought was going to crush Microsoft. I might suggest that the opposite happened, as you can imagine. That's why Cyan isn't available today. It's it got crushed really. So. But yeah, I mean, I've still got a Cyan 3C and it sits next to my bed and it makes a great alarm clock.
Those are some great things. Yeah. There was a whole range of devices, wasn't there? The ones with the keyboard, but there was a sort of handheld things that looked like a phone.
Funny you should say that. It's actually, if anyone watched The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and used to pull out the don't panic thing from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and it looked very much like a Cyan 2 or whatever. They used that for data logging in warehouses and such like. I bought an Atari portfolio back in the day. and it ran an early version of DOS, and it was it cost a lot of money at the time. I thought, that's fantastic, blah, 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 blah. And I filled the database with entries with phone numbers and all that. It took me a long time to type out all these numbers, and I had a week or so, and it went crash. Ah, I lost all the entries. So I did the same thing a second time, and it went crash a second time. That's it. So I sold that, and it was a lot of money. And I think on eBay, what it was a Sine 2, which by that point was really old hat. It didn't even have a QWERTY keyboard. It was like A, B, C, D, E, you know, in rows. And it was like square dot matrixy kind of display. It was a very rubbishy display and all that. And I didn't expect very much of it. I thought, this is going to be rubbish, you know. And I got it. And I discovered, the display is rubbish. It doesn't have as much memory. It's a slower processor, that's it. But it's been very carefully crafted and designed. It never, ever crashed. Never, ever crashed. Mm-hmm. It stored huge amounts of information. It just worked flawlessly. There's a difference between buying something that's all gimmicky and it looks the part, but it ends up being rubbish. Yeah. There's this thing which actually looks rubbish, but it's actually really well.
Less sexy, but actually cleverly executed.
And the bigger signs were the same. My Sine 3C, until recently, a year or so ago, what basically happened was the component specifications, I think, in the device drifted, and now the backup battery is reported as being flat all the time. So what happens is when the main battery fails, the Sine and then loses all of its information. But prior to that point in time, the Sine had never ever crashed. So I don't know, 10 plus years or something daft like that. Mm-hmm. It had never rebooted, never crashed, never lost a single byte of information. I mean, how many computers can you say that's the case?
It's true. Yeah.
So yeah, cleverly designed. And I bet you if you had a Windows CE machine, that would not be the case. But I could be wrong. I've never had ones, I don't know. But there you go.
Yeah. There's a lot of mileage in looking back at some of those bits of kit. I was just remembering as you were saying that, there was a guy at work years ago now who had one of these small handheld devices. I can't remember what it was, but it didn't have a keyboard, although there was an accessory you could buy for it where you effectively stood it on the keyboard or in front of it. I'm not sure what it was. But you could write things on this. It had a screen. You had to write in its own funny little scripting language.
What was that thing called? I know how what
you
this
know,
is.
You know what? Yeah,
I'll tell you why. Because I had a server called a Compaq iPack. Uh-huh. And every time I say iPack, people think I'm talking about a PDA. Mm-hmm. And it's an iPack. That's what it is.
Yeah.
But they also did a mini server that looks a bit like a fan heater. And I used to sit in my room and I used that as my home server. Uh-huh. But no, it's an iPack PDA. You had a stylus and you wrote.
You could represent whole words with some you could learn some symbol sequence that you could write
almost,
and you could actually write quite quickly with it in a strange hieroglyphic way.
I remember those.
It would be nice to research one of those again.
Yeah, I never had one of those.
I never had one. No. But I was always jealous of this guy Colin. He used to go and take meeting minutes using that thing.
Wow.
And
that's impressive.
You used to say, you don't need to take minutes for this one, Colin's doing it. Hey Colin.
How would that be possible? Just how well it worked.
Yeah, I know.
So, very good, very
great
good
stuff. Yeah. Reminiscence.
So, topic number two.
Oh, great.
It's not going to last very long. So I've been having difficulty with Audacity recently. And of course, I use it in Ubuntu and Snaps and whatnot. And of course, with this newer version of Ubuntu, because it uses Snaps, you get the very latest version of Audacity. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it takes a bit of time to switch on when you click the icon. It obviously Snap's doing its thing before it powers up. But I think what's happening is, and I haven't looked into it because I haven't got the time and I'm too lazy. So in fact, the other day I was recording an episode which I completely mucked up, but that's by the by. And I found that clicking the icon didn't launch Audacity at all, no matter how long I waited. Mm-hmm. And I think this happened previously, and I uninstalled it and reinstalled it. And I was actually going to get rid of the Snap package and just using it from the repository. Mm-hmm. Because I don't care if it's the latest one. But I think what's happening is association with the link changes. I think what happens is that the Audacity gets updated behind the scenes, and then the link's not working. Because if I open up a terminal and type Audacity, bang, it works. So it's no big deal. Yep. So that's just what I'm going to use the terminal.
yeah. I run Debian testing, so I'm used to occasionally some package gets an update, and it destroys it. I've lost Calibra at the moment, and it's really frustrating because I made EPUB notes for the last show I've submitted, and I can't read them. I can if I move to my laptop, but it's just one of those really niggly things.
Yes.
And it's the other one that really got me annoyed this past week or so. So I use Clementine as my music player.
All right, I don't think I've that's that's an Curtis thing, is it?
No, it's it came from KDE originally. Ah. What is it? It's a clone of what's it called? I've forgotten, it's gone up in my head now. There was a music player on KDE, which Amarok it was called.
Oh, Amarok, yes, I have tried
and
that
it's,
long
it's similar.
Ago.
I used to use Amarok all the time, and then they messed it up totally.
Right.
And then Clementine came along to fill the gap, so I've stuck with that for the moment. But it's got this really strange feature. The UI comes up and you use it, and then you tend to go to the corner and click the close button in the top corner of the window.
Oh, yes.
And it closes down, but it doesn't close. It just the UI goes away.
Right.
And you end up with you still got a little thing in the tray
status tree,
that's running.
Yeah.
If you go to that and quit it, then it goes away. When you start it up again, it comes back in the same state, and there's no means of getting from that little thing in the tray to the UI.
That's insane.
You have to go to the config file, find a line that says hidden equals true, and change that to hidden equals false, and then it comes back on again.
That's insane. Why would you want that?
I think an upgrade, in quotes, I'm waving my hands in the air, has done this, because you used to be able to just click on the thing in the tray and it would bring up the UI, but that doesn't work anymore. Frustrations.
Very, very good. I can see that with a problem. related to that, I had an issue with that HDI with the jacks, and I've got an Intel board, and it assigns the wrong type of device. When you plug it in, it says, "Oh, you're plugging in headphones." No, it's a blooming microphone. it's just drives you demented. So there's a package called, is it HDA Retask? I think it's called. Now it's got a button that says, "What is it?" I've got something. There's a thing where you try it out. But when you try it out, it doesn't work. It comes up with an error. And this could be an Ubuntu thing rather than anything else. But you just ignore that and just say, no, just actually apply the fix. And then when you reboot it, it works. But I spent ages thinking it wasn't working and trying different options in the UI to try and get this to work. And in fact, I gave up. And there's no way I came back to it. I think I went back to my wiki page and I looked. I thought, I've used this package before. And I looked at it and said, Don't use the trial thing. Just apply it and ignore any errors. I've forgotten about that. I've wasted hours.
It's a good idea to keep notes under those circumstances.
So
I do. I spend a lot of my time writing up what went wrong, what I did to fix it. So next time it happens, I can go and do it again. Frustration.
What distribution do you use?
Well, I got Raspbian on all. Well, I suppose not obviously, but I have got Raspbian on all of my Pis, just bog standard. Yeah. Often Raspbian Lite, because I don't use any UIs or anything. I just SSH into them all.
I think recently I've been using Raspbian Lite as well, but in the past I haven't. So yeah, that's a good point.
Well, when you come to a Pi Zero, then it's useful to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And I use Ken's technique of downloading the ISO and then hacking it to change the passwords and switch on SSH and all sort of stuff in the ISO, so I can then copy it around to various
systems. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember that. There's an episode on that. That's a good idea.
So that was very helpful. We did that,
which reminds me, using you've got a, because you've got that many pies around, you were saying that you've got a thing to to identify the configuration of the hat. Yeah, I tried that out. That's very cool.
Yeah, that runs on everything. Yeah. I keep everything in a wiki, so I know.
Oh, wikis are great. I keep telling people at work about wikis. And I was like, that should be a wiki. That's this look at me. What, Wikipedia? No, a wiki. And I got to explain the wikis and Wikipedia.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I had an uphill struggle at work doing that. I kept all my stuff in a wiki, which we were running on one of the central little central servers, but nobody else wanted to join in with it.
It was funny because I had they were looking for. It was one of the rare occasions where they're actually looking for feedback at work, and they said, you know, you're looking for anything. I said, well, how about a wiki so that people can contribute to it? And like, oh yeah, that's a good idea, you know. And then somewhere along the lines, I was looking because the management sort of reply to comments that come up basically, and I can't remember what it was, but somehow or other it warped from a wiki to something completely different. So they're going to do, I can't remember what it was, but it's not a wiki, so it's useless, you can't contribute to it. It was a complete waste. I said, well, I'm not going to bother. If you're not going to take it seriously, then what's the point, you know? It's just crazy. But I've seen there was a council, one of my relatives lives in the west coast. And I visited the council's website there, and they've got a wiki. That's fantastic. You've got, like, you know, Jimmy the Butcher and all these various local businesses have got wee bits. And then any wee special interest groups, they've got their things. And I think, God, you know, a council, that they've got one of the best council websites that I've come across, rather than these corporate things that are full of junk and you can't find anything on it. You know, it's useless information.
They're so often scared of people writing rude words or something on there.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it all gets checked before it goes out. Yeah. So there's no problem.
It's not hard to build a site where you have a sort of vetting stage before.
Yeah,
before
exactly.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. It's very odd.
Yeah.
But I use a MediaWiki instance on a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
And that works fine. For me, in fact, I've got things where I keep stuff in a database, and then I've written scripts which take a snapshot out of the database, turn it into MediaWiki markup stuff, then sends it to the Raspberry Pi, and then runs using SSH a PHP script on the Raspberry Pi.
Wow.
So it will actually insert it into the wiki.
It just amazes me the things you script. I mean, I don't know, because Dave was telling me that, I don't know if I should be saying, but anyway. So about your scripted menu choice.
Oh yeah, that'll have to be an HBR episode at some
script,
stage.
Yeah. Food choice by script.
Superb. My kids think I'm slightly insane. They knew that already.
I think I use I've got a wiki site, but it's not my own. I think if I'd started with wikis at a different time, I would have used more, and I did contemplate using, like, I have played with MediaWiki and wiki and all these other things as well, but I think because I'd spent so much time with the first site that I used, and what was it called now? Wiki.org, I think it's called. And I think, it was a Polish chap and I could get this, wrong, but he gave it to the community for a sort of thing to use, and there was no charge. And then I think it got bought by a corporate company or something, but they allowed the old members to stay free. It might still be free, I'm not sure, but the point is, I'm still with Wiki.org, and I think I used, I created awk and said scripts that sort of tried to convert, I use the word tried to convert the markdown from Wiki.org to, I think it was MediaWiki or whatever it was, and it was fairly successful, but then after spending loads of time creating these scripts and converting my text, I never actually used it, so it's been a bit of a waste of time really, but I think one day I will get back to using MediaWiki, I think, and have it running on my own Pi rather than...
I think, I may be wrong, but I think that Pandoc, which is a document converter, understands MediaWiki Markdown in either in input or more in output or both.
But they won't understand Wiki.org, I don't think.
No,
No, that's the problem, no, you no. see. So
that's right. That's why why I was agreeing with you effectively, you know, moving to MediaWiki.
Yeah.
Because I think you could write a bit of Markdown stuff and then generate MediaWiki stuff out as an output.
This is it.
I need to check this to be absolutely certain, but I'm pretty certain that MediaWiki Markup, confusing, is one of the options. So, you know, there's all sorts of possibilities.
This is it. Yeah, absolutely. I also use I use Ubuntu and Raspbian, obviously, but I also use OSMC, Open Source Media Center.
Right.
And I run that on a Pi downstairs, and I've got a Plusberry Pi. It's basically a box, and it's got it was for the earlier Pis. I think only had two USB sockets, so it's got a powered kind of hubby thing inside there, so it gives you like four USBs out. And there's a space for a fan, and it also, you can put a hard drive in it as well, although I never actually did that. I planned to do it, but I found it actually more convenient to have an external one, because at least that way you can unplug it and take it away. If you put it in the box, it's difficult to get to. But it was quite an expensive case, because it was a limited number that they, you know, it was through a Kickstarter type thing. But and then of course, I'm fairly sure it won't support the very latest Pi.
So I've got a
Pi 3B, which I was planning to use for media, but I'm not sure I can, and I'd probably need to rebuild it, because I don't think the OSMC that's on that wouldn't work on the 3B, and it's a finding in time and inclinations. So I've got this 3B that I use for hardly anything upstairs. It's my most powerful Pi, and I've got this older Pi running as a media set. I've got it the wrong way round, but when I get time, you know, one of these days, it's always the same. Yeah.
That's not a thing I've tried. I've gone away from media totally. I don't watch telly or movies or anything like that. So I survived with that.
Yeah,
writing scripts on most of the time.
Yeah. I think if I had more free time, I'd be doing the same. but I don't. So
So. I think you ran Debian. I think you mentioned Debian at one point. Was that you just saying effectively that Debian is under is what Ubuntu is?
In
one of your shows recently, you said on Debian you would type apt-get blah blah blah.
It's a Debian. Obviously, Ubuntu is a Debian-based in quotes distribution with apt and whatnot. What do you call it? The app, the package manager, that's what I'm looking for. I think I did run Debian a wee bit at one point, but I had Debian on a laptop, I did. But I think, as far as Linux is concerned, I'm a bit of a pragmatist, you know, and I just want something that's going to be convenient. I absolutely appreciate that, Debian's more pure than, like, say, Ubuntu, I suppose, and there's something even more pure than Debian, but I just want something to work, and it's...
I did install Debian on a machine at one point and thought, oh, yeah, this is great, and it's going to be stable forever. Then I realised, hang on, there's a new version of this and a new version of that, and it's not available.
Yeah.
It's not in the repository, so that's no good. That's why I moved to Debian testing.
Yeah.
So it's slightly frustrating. I used to run Ubuntu a lot, and I've run Fedora quite a lot in the past, but at the moment I've got Debian testing on my desktop, which is my main machine, and I've got a laptop which has got KDE Neon on it, which is actually very good, which is basically Ubuntu with tons of KDE hacks on it.
I've never really got, I think very, very beginning, funny, I think way back in the day, I had a play with Linux. But I never really went very far, and it was all just kind of GUI stuff. I didn't know anything about bash scripting or anything like that, and or even how to configure it. It was just on a CD, and I managed to dual boot it, and I was amazed it didn't break the computer at the time, so it was way back. Red Hat 5.1 or something like that, way back. So, and then although I was amazed at it, I didn't really know what to do with it, and that was as far as I went. And then I really got into Linux properly. What was it now? It was GF. I'm going through all the Ubuntu names. So AGF. Yeah, AGF. I think AGF was the first one, that was 1606 or something like that, or 1604. Something like that, anyway, was when I first got into Linux properly. And you know, it was. I think at that point I was finding Windows boring. I think that was. That's too easy. It just works. You know? So that was the thing. And then I got an Ubuntu book. Wasn't Idiot's Guide. It was something like that. Fantastic. I read it from cover to cover, sort of thing. And that was it, sort of thing. I was just hooked, you know. So it's mostly been Ubuntu that I've stuck with. I have played with other distributions on laptops and stuff. And it was that. Now, what was that one? Kind of Debian based. That was the one that was quite common. It was a wee small distribution that went by the wayside. What they were talking about just another podcast I was listening to the other day. I can't remember. There's so many out there. That's right.
You talking about other distributions? I just remembering I've got a Triple E PC, those little tiny netbooks, still runs.
So does mine.
And I had installed Crunchbang on that.
That's it.
Was that what you were thinking?
Crunchbang.
Yes,
yes.
I wondered if you were.
And that was good on my. I had another laptop. It was a HP compact laptop anyway, and it needed to be quite a low powered thing, and it was great. Crunchbang run superb on that.
It was really good. So sad when in fact I met Mr. Crunchbang at OGCamp, Philip Newborough. It's good to see him.
Because he just wrote that kind of for himself, and was I think he was became, quite surprised that the way it took off, sort of thing.
Yes. I think it was a bit of a burden for him in many respects.
I'm sure it would be.
I've never really talked to him about why he felt it was best to break away from it, but you know, I'm sure there were good reasons. But it's a shame.
I mean, I think this one of the other experiences I use is that OSMC thing I was thinking about. As a young chap, he was quite young at the time when he started that up, and because you could do, was it OpenElec or something like that, was the other one, but that was not run by a company, whereas the OSMC was a young chap. He was really quite young when he started it, and he was very good. It meant a lot of effort. I haven't given him a sub, but I used to kind of at Christmas time sort of helpful hand sort of thing, because he obviously took a lot of effort to do these sort of things. And I think he created a hardware thing, which it solved some of the shortcomings of the early Pis, but of course with the newer Pis coming out, I think maybe the timing was a wee bit unfortunate, because he produced this and then not long after the Pis, the higher spec Pis came out, which meant that his hardware wasn't so appealing necessarily. But I mean, to get not only create this really slick distribution, but to also come up with a bit of hardware as well, that's a heck of a undertaking to do that. Very good.
Impressive. When I first started using Linux, it was one of the early Red Hats. I think it was 4. We were running Unix at work, and one of my colleagues said, "Oh, you should try this Linux." I think he was doing a part-time job working in a cyber cafe. Do you remember cyber cafe?
Yes.
And it was all Linux. And he said, "We should try installing it." And I said, "I don't know." I was pretty much of the mindset that we're buying this kit, we're getting the manufacturer's operating system, and that was the way to go. But he managed to convince me. And I
hear you after that one.
It took a little while to be convinced.
My ex-colleagues
tell me, you were really slow in getting on there. But eventually did. So it was Red Hat was one of the main things at that point. And then that turned into Fedora. Because the Red Hat were not doing a desktop version anymore at that point. And then so I ran Fedora with KDE for quite a time. And then I went to Ubuntu with KDE, so Kubun, for a very long time.
And it's so easy to forget how much more difficult thing, because I remember back on Red Hat 5.1 and even the earlier versions of Ubuntu, the things that you had to do, you know, to get things working, yes. You know.
Tweaking what was it called? X media.
X, that's X was a right nuisance.
I forget you what the config file was.
You could blow your run if you got it wrong.
You had to put the frequency of the scan frequency or something.
And then getting your wireless card to work up was a nightmare as well. A modem.
Absolutely.
But you learned a lot doing that, I suppose.
I think my pal from work, he said, here's the easiest way, because we all had access to old PCs at that time because they would get chucked out of the student rooms and upgraded, and all the old machines would just be given away.
Yeah.
And so we all had one or two of these knocking around. So I probably had something like a Pentium 4 or those types of things. Mm-hmm. Said, here's a disk, just plug it in, boot off, and you'll have Linux. Mm-hmm. And I did that, and then copied the disk content. So he'd done the config for most of it. And since they were standardized machines with standardized monitors across the range, it was a fairly easy task. It was only later on when I upgraded that I suddenly, it's not as easy as I remember.
Yes.
Gave me an easy time, Simon, who did.
I think I've actually Linux actually was able to. I'm trying to think what it was now. You could run it from what was it called? It's like it's one of these tiny small distributions. I was able to run. I was actually able to run it at work. Mm-hmm. I was able to do small wee bash testing. You know, it wasn't actually for work. You know, generally since you're locked down, you can't do that sort of thing. So,
We had a lot of Unix workstations due to some weird decision that had been made by somebody senior in the university. So we had a lot of Ultrix workstations, which we had to manage. And so we were using that version of Unix quite. Didn't have Bash. I think it was too early for Bash. But we had SH and CSH and TCSH and things. It was a fair bit of scripting got done. There, because we were managing these things, and you often need to write a fair bit of tweaking at the sort of scripting level, so that sort of thing.
There's not a bash terminal you can get from within a browser. There's not, you can log into something that you use. It's emulating it uses Flash. It can actually. JavaScript bash terminal, which is quite interesting.
You can do quite a lot in
JavaScript. There's online Python, which you can. That's great fun as well. Because in fact, that's for my project, there's that box thing that I've talked about. You know, for controlling my Raspberry Pi upstairs, free time or work. What's it, online Python, I can't remember. But you can obviously you can get an account for them, but you can try things out and you can't save it, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's surprising how featured Replica, it's called Replica or something like that. It's an online Python thing, and so you can run the code and try wee snippets and whatnot, which was good to try it. Idea, it was surprising. Quite powerful actually.
I was saying to you as we would. Before we started recording, I really trying to convince myself to get into Python, though I have a strong aversion to some aspects of it.
Could it be tab?
it's the damn indents, really.
We've discussed all this, I think with Python, you almost have to use the exact same editor all the time and never change because if you have a different number of spaces, a different number of tabs, you can
you can easily fall down big holes.
So I was telling Dave, I use a strange editor. I don't think that many people use it, but it's MC Edit. It comes with Midnight Commander, and it's just because it was handy and convenient. And the only thing that was rubbish about it was the terrible colour scheme. It was like blue on,
white on blue?
Something like that, and it was hard to read, you know.
That is meant to be the most visible. I remember when Windows were pushing that as a big thing.
Was it Edit? It was called, it was a thing called Edit. It was a couple of DOS. Anything I could edit.
Yeah, I think it probably was a DOS thing. Right. Yeah, and they also within things like Word, that they were encouraging you to go for a white on blue.
What perfect was that? All that color.
Yeah, I think it was quite. It was meant to be. I've never got on too well with that, I have to say. But yeah, there must be some ergonomics behind there somewhere. I don't know, but yeah.
but you can change a color scheme and name, it, so it's fine. It's funny actually. I was trying another editor just recently. At work a while back, somebody had recommended Notepad++. And then I thought, of course, there's nothing like that on Linux. And then I heard somebody talking about, I think it might be HPR, talking about Notepad QQ, which is a play on Notepad++. So I installed it just the other day, and it's quite nice. It's, I've still got all the features of Notepad++, but again, maybe it's the way it's installed on Ubuntu, but when you highlight it, you know, highlighting stuff, it's dreadful. The colours are awful. You can't see what's behind it. Oh, it's awful, you know.
There's nothing worse than that.
So it's funny. Some of the, some of the Ubuntu stuff with the newer Ubuntu GUI, I don't necessarily get on with it. The file manager is so basic, you know. It seems to be that you know, for example, I've actually got a frustration installed Nemo. That was the old Nautilus type file manager, which doesn't work. There's niggles with it sometimes, and sometimes it can do things. I don't know, it crashes or something. So I'm not totally trusting it. So if it's simple stuff, I use the standard Ubuntu file manager, but often I've got to drop to this Nemo one because, well, for example, you can't do left and right split panes.
Right.
Now, tabs are fine for simple this to that, but if you're taking from this to that, then something else to that, then something else to that, then you're all over the place. Whereas with the two panels, you've got the destination staying there, and you can go to your source, multiple sources.
I couldn't live without that.
No.
I use... Dolphin, is it Dolphin?
Oh, yeah.
The KDE.
Oh, yes.
KDE
file manager. I've never even got home with KDE.
It's so nice that you can split the screen and move things about, and you're going to have multiple tabs, each of which is split.
You can do all that with Nemo, that's right.
But this
Ubuntu file manager, I couldn't see, I could be wrong, but I couldn't see how to, it doesn't show you. I've got a Windows partition. It doesn't see it, so I can't mount it. Mm-hmm. I've got to go to this Nemo thing. Oh, there it is. Here, I can now click on it. And and then the other thing is, if you're scrolling through the window, the way that the window is displayed, you lose the last line.
Mm.
So and it tends to be the last felt at the very bottom. Mm-hmm. What date stamp is that? What size is it? Oh, I can't see it. Oh, it's so frustrating.
Yeah,
just
those sorts of
things like that. You know.
Irritating. The Dolphin thing, it just seems to get better and better. It does things like highlighting files and directories that are under the control of Git, and I think it shows some sort of status information in there too, and things like a side panel in which you can have directories that you often go to. You just click on them and go there. But also in there, there's a list of remote systems, like a lot of my Pis are on there.
Yeah.
So you click on that and it SSHs to it, and you get a panel that shows the contents of the thing.
It's very good.
Without that, life would be absolutely abysmal.
The Nemo file manager gives you a wee orange line underneath it, which gives you at a glance, oh, that's half full or three quarters full. There's a lot of nice wee touches in the Nemo. But as I say, it's slightly flaky under Ubuntu, so I don't totally trust
it. It's been my experience throughout using computers in the past sort of 30, 40 years or something. That people come up with brilliant ideas and then a sea change happens.
Water it down.
They throw all those ideas away and come up with a bunch of crappy ideas.
That's right. And in fact, the another thing with the Ubuntu, the issue is trying to get my audio working properly with Audacity. And I just discovered just the other day that when I pushed the speaker icon, they've now included, which I think I had before, or it was quite awkward to get. It wasn't too bad to get to, but it was, but they made it even more difficult to get to the mic gain on the later Ubuntu's. But folk have obviously been complaining about that, because out, just by magic, it's appeared from nowhere. I've got two sliders, I've got a volume and a mic gain just from a single click on the status, so that's really nice.
That's good.
So that was very handy. I thought, where did that come from? It just appeared from nowhere. So
I don't actually record in Audacity. I used to get problems with it though.
Right.
But I must give that another shot.
Ah.
I record all my podcasts on my Zoom, which is what we're recording.
Just sitting on the dashboard right now, yeah.
Yeah.
Flickering away to us.
And then I download off the SD card and then put it in Audacity and edit it.
Why else would you use any others? It's such a nice...
But I've got a microphone which I could go straight to Audacity with, so maybe give that a shot, actually, now you say that.
Yeah, I've said before, I use gamers headphones with a boom mic, and I find it keeps the microphone in the same position.
Mm-hmm.
And they were cheap, scabby things, you know, oh dear. But the problem I have, as I've mentioned before again, is everything's too big. They fall off my face. It's like putting headphones on a child, you know, just way too big.
Yeah, so, you think they'd be more adjustable.
Yeah,
those sorts of things.
Actually, because it's so big, the cups curl round, so they're almost like under my chin, you know. So I've got to have one ear on and the other one off to the side. And that's just quite convenient, because it means I can hear things going on in the room or whatever.
That has some advantages, doesn't it?
Yeah, but they were cheap and they seem to work quite well. So that's how a good cheap solution if somebody's looking for a way of recording, and everyone's got maybe not nowadays, because everyone's got a computer, but most folk just have phones and tablets now. So
it's true.
So
I've got a Samsung microphone on a boom arm, which is mounted over my desk. So that's what I use to record the community news and that sort of stuff. And it's really
good.
It's a USB mic, but it's serviced. It's really good quality wise.
Yeah,
I should really record more on that. Although this one is pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has tune it right. It can pick up sound from where you want it to.
Well, you're telling me it's got huge. I mean, how many microphones has it got?
I think it's got five microphones in it.
My God.
If I remember right.
And of course, we'll have all different kinds of modes for different conditions.
Can switch it into different configurations. Yeah. You can record meetings or just have a sort of chat with somebody and record just that.
I think there's a whole deep topic that you can dive into just with microphones and different configurations, and I'm sure, I bet they come with a manual. Has it got a manual? They come with a manual?
Big
manual.
Quite a significant manual.
It
took me a while to find out how to do something with it. I was trying to listen back to what we'd recorded last time on it, which you can do, but it's not obvious at all.
we were sort of scratching our heads.
Struggling in there. After we'd recorded, did that all work?
Good stuff.
There's a lot of hidden features in there. Up to 40.
Oh, that's long. That's long.
It'll be less once we've trimmed it.
And I've also, hopefully, I didn't ramble at a massively high speed like I did last time. I'm consciously trying to speak nice and slowly. Sorry, people.
That should be fine.
That's my pure Scottish accent.
It's good. That's fun. It's fun to do this.
Indeed.
It's the second time we've met and chatted, and it sounds like there's about an infinity of subjects that we can get into if we put our minds to it.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's
to be filled with scrambled egg and toast and things. That's nice, yeah.
Yeah, we had a late breakfast and a long, 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 long chat. So.
Absolutely.
And we must come back here, actually, because this is a nice place.
Yeah,
I like it's a pub, isn't it?
Yeah,
but it's also a little restaurant at the back there, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, did they have rooms as well? I'm not quite sure.
I'm not sure.
I found out about it because it's dog friendly, so since we have like a companion, so it's quite handy from that.
We're quite close to a sort of walking area, because that's Hill End Ski Slope is just above us, and there's a lot of people just take the trail up there, which you can do and walk along the Pentlands.
I was just saying, all of us, for some reason, I mean, I don't come here that often, but I've heard this weekend, last weekend I was with a radio meetup, and then, actually it was a weekend before, we came in here to take, was me and me and Mrs. X, and our furry companion. And after the meal, I've eaten too much, but maybe should go for a wee walk sort of thing. And there's a wee footpath, as you say, takes you up to the car park.
Yeah.
And we were walking up all the way, so it's quite dark. And of course, it said, we'll use a footpath. It looks a bit muckier. We'll not use a footpath. So we can see the oncoming traffic because we walk on the right-hand side, so you can see the oncoming traffic. So that's a wee tip, because I always say to people, walk on the right-hand side. If you're driving the left, of course, we're in the UK, and I'm now talking too quickly. And so we got to the top, and we're walking back down, and we got halfway down, and we heard this kind of rhythmical noise. And what the heck's going on? And so we sort of turned around, and we could see these kind of, it was like a whole cluster of illuminations that were kind of bobbing up and down. And what the hell's that? We couldn't, because it's pitch dark, we couldn't work out what it was. And the dog's looking at us, and we're looking at it, and we're looking at what the hell's going on here, you know? And they're getting closer and closer and closer. And it turned out it was people who'd been jogging up the side of Helene. And it was, hello, hiya, hello. And they just see a lights on the forehead.
They all had little
headlights on. Yeah, wow. Really strange.
Yeah, this is quite an area for exercise and stuff.
And that was the other thing. A lot of them were they'd obviously jogged up to the top of this hill back down again. And some of them were jogging home. And others were getting on bikes. And,
wow.
Yeah, God, they're really seriously fit.
I've never been there.
No. We were just going to walk up the hill back down again.
I have, my kids both done skiing lessons here. And when they had their lessons, I used to hang about. And I would walk up the side of the ski slope and round the top back down the other side and that sort of thing. And that's quite a steep hill, actually. Yeah. You need some good boots on there to be able to do it. Well, it's a good place for a ski slope and stuff. You don't do that on an icy day, though, because you'll be on your backside and sliding fast. you need the skis. It's one of the nicest hills around this area.
Very handy.
And then there's the whole Pentlands along the way there, which is great.
Indeed. So.
Anyway, enough of that.
Well, we're at now.
Thank you very much.
46 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, well, silence, truncation, hopefully, we'll trim it a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, I'll call a stop here.
So, goodbye from Hacker.
Public
Radio.
Very good.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license. We'll